on the internet. You, of course, won't get much accomplished. That's a satellite feed. 4 hours live, archive programs, MP3, blogs. Get the information, get others to listen, and then please pray for America. Pray for revival, but please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at and that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of William Grigg, who formerly was the senior editor for the New American Magazine. Today, he writes a blog. He has his own radio program, and certainly one of the best commentators we have. You'll see his articles up on the internet on a regular basis at Lou Rockwell, or posted at newswithviews.com, or certainly posted at World Affairs Brief. So we certainly always look forward to having William with us every Friday evening here at this hour. Hi, good evening, William. Are you feeling better this evening?
Dr. Stan, I'm feeling very well. Thank you so much for asking, and thank you so much for sending me the supplements. They've been a real godsend.
Well, I'm glad that they are. I'm just glad to have you back on your feet. We need you.
Thank you.
So I'm reading all of the articles that you've written this week. It looks like this has been a very prolific week for you.
Yeah, there's a lot happening. As a matter of fact, as you know, you more than most people would understand this, it's impossible to keep up with what's happening as the great unraveling is underway and gathers speed. There's a fancy French word, denouement, that is used in drama to describe what happens in the last act when all the threads of the narrative that have gathered together in the knot of conflict start to unravel. It means a great unraveling. And that's what started to happen in earnest in 2008. And as things are being unstitched, they're being stitched together in a different tapestry, a different fabric, one that is really quite alien to our expectations as free people. It's a very familiar circumstance, the broad sweep of history, that you'd have people who are unaccountable in positions of power, both economically and politically. That's been more or less the fate of mankind for most of recorded history, with a couple of very brief blessed parentheses in what is otherwise an undifferentiated story of woe and oppression. And when the United States was created as an independent republic in the 1780s, after our colonial forebears had wrested their independence from the British Empire, there was something new in the world that had never been seen before, which is a country that we now refer to as a middle-class civilization. A middle-class civilization, quite simply, is this. It's a society in which anybody, through dint of his effort and discipline and his determination, has the opportunity to improve his lot in life, to own what he makes, and to transmit what he makes to those who come after him. You're not born into a system in which your station in life is determined by a peerage or by a hierarchy, by an aristocracy. You're not consigned eternally to one particular niche in society for the rest of your life, but you have the right, the ability, the opportunity to develop whatever cluster of talents our Creator has blessed you with, and to improve your life, the life of your family, and the life of those who interact with you. That's something that was really quite uncommon. Even now it's uncommon, but at the time, in the early early part of our experience as a nation, the late 18th century, it was all but unheard of. And we're reverting back to form now, unfortunately. We're seeing something that is sort of a hyper-feudalist type of a society take form. That's something that's foreign to our expectations and our experience. Unfortunately, it's very common in the history of mankind, and unless we take action right now, that's going to be the future of our children. You know what? I'm not willing to settle for that.
Well, I think that the reason that you do what you do and the reason that I do what I do is to try to get people to understand that freedom simply hangs today by a thread. And basically, they're forging the chains for the people, as Thomas Jefferson said so well. In matters of politics, speak not to me of confidence in men, but bind them down from mischief with the chains of the Constitution. Well, they've taken the chains off the politicians. They're forging them for the people. There really are people who want to enslave other people of this country, and it's just about ready to befall us, unless, of course, we stand against it. William, go right ahead.
One of the things that we have talked about quite a bit, Dr. Stan, and this is something that we cannot overstate and we cannot repeat too frequently, is the fact that there is a definable self-perpetuating oligarchy that is in charge of the main instruments of economic, financial, military, political power, academic power, media power in this country and elsewhere in the world. C. Wright Mills, more than a half century ago, referred to it as the power elite. Its machinations were documented by Carol Quigley. You can read a wonderful book by the late Christopher Lash that came out in 1994, early 1995, called The Revolt of the Elites. They all talk about the same group of people. And what you're looking at right now in terms of the Obama administration's actions, its policies, the way that it's coordinating policies with like-minded elites on the other side of the Atlantic, is really the unabashed unveiling of what had been sort of a semi-submerged oligarchy. Now, there simply is no pretense anymore as to what they are doing and why they're doing it. There, of course, are occasional perfunctory gestures intended to placate the masses when these acts of grand larceny on an unprecedented scale, where everything that we earn, everything we have saved, everything we have tried to keep, that's the product of our honest labor, is being malted, being plundered, for the benefit of criminal elites in the world of high finance, the elevated, exalted world of the banksters. Every once in a while, the people responsible for this will make some kind of noise to the extent that this is intended to make sure that things don't get as bad as they possibly could get. But they don't really go so far as to try to say what they're doing is objectively right. They're just doing it because they can. And it gets to the point of such brutal and vulgar obviousness that you have now in this Elena Kagan, the nominee for a Supreme Court vacancy, somebody whose resume is very, very thin in terms of being an actual jurist, but whose paper trail, which of course was something that she husbanded with a great deal of care and diligence, she, from the time she was an undergraduate, she wanted to be a Supreme Court justice. That's really an interesting element of her biography. But you have here somebody who was joined at the hip to Goldman Sachs. From 2005 to 2008, she was part of an advisory committee, albeit one that dealt with political affairs rather than investment decisions. But she was joined at the hip with really what has to be considered, by all rational moral definitions, a criminal syndicate, perhaps one of the most important and powerful in the history of mankind, and one that is deeply implicated in the marrow-deep corruption that was fostered by the Federal Reserve during the housing bubble, where they were ripping off investors to the tune of billions of dollars.
Hold that thought. Well, certainly this is Dr. Stan, and of course, William is talking about Ms. Kagan. Ms. Kagan, who, of course, is running, has been nominated to become the Supreme Court Justice. And, of course, William is simply pointing out the close ties between her and the criminal syndicate, the Goldman Sachs. And for 3 years, she was joined together with them in an advisory capacity. Now, should we think that there might be something to be concerned about? Certainly, Goldman Sachs was one of the largest contributors, almost $1 million, to Barack Obama's campaign. There was an article in Rolling Stone is talking about all the people from the Goldman Sachs who are in the Obama administration in key positions. And certainly we should be very, very concerned when we see one major banking institution, with this much influence. And now one of their disciples, one of their former agents, is going to be appointed to the Supreme Court if the Senate goes along with it. And I'm sure they will because, of course, suddenly the nomination process is all political theater to give the American people the idea that the Republicans are really concerned that we might be getting somebody who is not impartial. Is there anybody who really thinks that this woman will be impartial on the subject of homosexuality in the military or certainly of the rights of individual citizens under the Constitution? But you can pick up the story there.
You're exactly right. You're dealing here with an interesting hybrid, this ruling ideology that is defining what the Obama administration did and sort of defining a new consensus. I hate to use that type of locution because that's right out of the Psalter of the collectivists when you talk about a new consensus. But that's how they create the momentum for consolidating powers. They define what the acceptable questions are. They define the questions that can be asked in such a way that the answer is going to advance the consolidation of power in a collectivist direction. But you've got an interesting hybrid here in the personality of Elena Kagan. She's somebody who has been very close to some of the worst and most statist elements of the conservative movement. She's somebody who is very comfortable, for instance, dealing with some of the really hardcore authoritarian personalities in the Federalist Society, which promoted, unfortunately, during the Bush administration, many of the assertions of unfettered executive power that the Obama administration is now running with. There really is a great deal of continuity between the doctrines of executive power created by David Addington and John Yoo and the people surrounding Dick Cheney during the Bush administration and what the Obama administration is doing right now. The biggest difference that I can see is that where Cheney and that entire clique were trying to create doctrines under which the president could imprison or torture somebody at whim, imprison somebody indefinitely, and then authorize the torture of that individual without any kind of recourse or legal protection. Now the Obama administration simply leapfrogged into new territory by saying that the president of the United States can order the summary execution of anybody he considers to be an unlawful combatant aligned with terrorist groups by way of a remote-controlled drone or whatever means might be at his disposal. That's something that not even the Bush administration asserted. And it's really an ironic and infuriating thing, for me anyhow, to see and hear so many conservatives criticizing Obama as being a weak president when it comes to all these powers asserted by Bush in the name of fighting terrorism, which is a problem almost entirely of Washington's creation. When he's doing exactly the same things that Bush did, he's asserting the power more forcefully, and he's proceeding a little bit more subtly, and Elena Kagan, as the Solicitor General, was somebody who signed off on all of these things.
And going along with Mr. Yu, who said that torture was all right. You know, one of the great books of all time was Witness by Whitaker Chambers.
Yes.
I don't know if you remember the book, but I read this probably 45 years ago. It had a profound impact. But one of the things Whitaker Chambers said, that one reason he eventually turned against communism because he knew they tortured people, and sometimes he'd wake up at nights and in his imagination he'd hear the people screaming in pain from the torture being inflicted by the communists. But then how is the torture inflicted by the communists any different than the screams of the torture inflicted by the courageous disciples of George Bush? Many of these people, most of them were actually innocent, and they just tortured them until they would confess to something. How can a moral people go along with that? Where was the outcry from our religious leaders, from our conservative leaders? Who spoke out against the torture, other than perhaps a few left-wing Democrats did? But where was the Republican leadership? Where was the moral leadership? Where was the Christian leadership? And, of course, it was all, there was no criticism because, after all, everybody knows God is a Republican.
So we're told now, and the interesting thing, as you describe what happened during the Bush administration when torture was being institutionalized, is that you had the beginning sort of a very weak and watered-down critique by people who identified as leftists. Those people are silent now because there's been a partisan polarity shift. And that's what happens every 2, 4, 6, or 8 years when suddenly a different alignment exists and Team B is in power rather than Team A. You've got the red team rather than the blue team, or the blue team rather than the red team who are on the offensive, and suddenly the relationship described by Lenin that defines politics, who does what to whom, suddenly you have a do-say-do that takes place. I call this the dialectical do-say-do, where suddenly the who becomes the whom and vice versa. And for people who are governed by that philosophy, or by that anti-philosophy, by that ideology, the important thing is you always want to be the who rather than the whom. You want to be the doer rather than the person to whom it is done. And you define morality in terms of what is being done to you and your interests, or whether your oxen are the ones that are being gored and dressed for dinner. The thing is, if you're a Christian, if you're somebody who subscribes to the idea that there is an eternal law that's written on our hearts by our Creator, and that law defines the limits of what we can do and our obligations to each other in ways that are not subject to revision according to the dictates of convenience, you can't take that position. There were, during the Bush administration, a handful of conservatives who condemned torture. There were some people in the Southern Baptist Convention who tardily but blessedly, at long last, recognized the fact that torture is a grave offense against God and man. I remember a very wise man by the name of Robert Welch, back in 1969, wrote a document called the John Birch Resolutions. I believe it was a 20-point manifesto, if you will, describing the social ills and the moral ills that were afflicting our country back then. It was really quite an interesting document. He mentioned abortion and euthanasia. Abortion, of course, became a matter of great public concern a few years later with Roe versus Wade. Euthanasia is now becoming a subject of concern because of what's going on with the corporate consolidation of fascist-style medicine thanks to Obamacare, but a number of things that have been happening since Nixon as well. But one of the things that Robert Welch specifically and emphatically talked about in the John Birch Resolutions back in 1969 was torture. And he said that torture, if you understand what is being done here, is even worse than cold-blooded murder because of what it does by way of robbing the torture victim, the tortured individual, of his humanity, and also the way that it propagates a type of subhuman bestial sadism on the part of those who inflict torture. He'd studied that for exactly the same reasons that you mentioned, Dr. Stan, in terms of what that said about the psychology of hardcore collectivism. And now, at its root, at its essence, the communist anti-life ideology is based on the prerogative of torturing other human beings in order to make them submit and recognize the supposed deity of the state. I remember vividly that passage toward the beginning of Witness by Whitaker Chambers when in explaining why it was that he decided to defect from communism. There are two epiphanies he had. One of them was a moment of beauty where he was caressing the tiny ear of his newborn baby daughter, and he suddenly realized that what he was looking at was no random combination of atoms and molecules. He was looking at a delicate artifact, a piece of divine handiwork that is this magnificent instrument called the human ear. That's something that simply couldn't have evolved in an unsponsored universe. There had to be some kind of creative entity that ordained the existence of that child and that created these wonderful faculties of hearing and sight and intellect in this beautiful little individual he was cradling in his arms. So suddenly he realized that he believed in God, which of course is incompatible with communism. And then, of course, when he was visiting Moscow, he said, "One night I heard screams." And the screams, of course, were the anguished exclamations being made by people who were being tortured by the agents of a godless regime. So he had somebody who recognized there is a God and recognized that torture is the negation of what God has decreed in terms of our obligations to each other. And during the last 8 years, this is something that absolutely chills me down to my bone marrow. You see people who are proud, self-described Christians by the millions, acting as if the highest and holiest function of the government ruling us is embodied in the summary torture of people who are accused of being terrorists. Of course, being designated a terrorist by the government doesn't mean that somebody is a terrorist. You're accused of a crime, and until the government can prove meet the standard of evidence dictated by our Constitution that you committed that crime, you're innocent as a matter of law. But you have these people willing to leapfrog this entire set of requirements imposed on us by the constitutional tradition, by the Anglo-Saxon common law, by the laws of God as described in the Bible, which do talk about the need for two witnesses to a crime. You have to overcome a presumption of innocence under the biblical standard in order to punish somebody for a crime. They're doing away with all this, and they're imputing to the state a type of deity. And Elena Kagan is there. She's somebody who is a doctrinaire socialist, has been since she was an undergraduate. She's somebody who has aspired to become a jurist in order to mold through legal opinions. First of all, she's been the Solicitor General, so she's already played a role in this. She was a legal counsel to Bill Clinton during the Clinton administration. She's in the same place right now that the authoritarian conservatives are, so that's the hybrid ideology that's governing us right now, unfortunately. And it's not likely to get better anytime soon.
No, what we really need, of course, is a moral revival. I don't see it coming. Well, if it doesn't come, though, we will see God's judgment on America. Go right ahead, William.
Dr. Stan, when you talk about God's judgment...
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a 4-tape or a 4-CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer Iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets that'll protect your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances, even things which can cause sickness or disease? If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Verky water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Verky water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-730-9796.
Tells Samuel what to tell the people, you know, what will happen if they have a king. People want a king. God says you don't want a king. And people said we want a king. So God tells Samuel, these are the things that you shall tell the people, if they have a king. And first of all, the king's going to tax them 10% of whatever they have. And I've always said, basically, of course, in those days, kings were pikers next to the IRS. But then, of course, that they were going to have the sons and daughters running beside his chariot in wars, and it'd always be the wars. And certainly the people were going to lose their freedom if they had a king. So pick up the story.
Yeah, that's what he said. And unfortunately, under the influence of people who aspired to power and understood that a monarchy is a better arrangement for sating that appetite for power than the decentralized patriarchal, I guess you'd call it a republic, that existed beforehand, they said, no, we want a king anyway. And so Samuel once again approached the Lord. As it says in 1 Samuel chapter 8, the Lord said to him, Samuel, they've not rejected you, they've rejected me. And so we're going to give them what they want. But even then, and this is, I think, an illustration of God's preternatural patience with us, despite our determined, perverse insistence on ignoring what's best for us, even then, Samuel, under God's direction, wrote a constitution for the monarchy. It was a constitutional monarchy. There's a passage in the ninth or tenth chapter, talking about how Samuel wrote the order of the kingdom. In other words, the king couldn't simply rule as he willed. He was governed by law. And that lasted not that long, because pretty soon King Saul, unfortunately, who had been very meek and diffident to the point where he was hiding among his luggage when the people came to bring him out for his coronation, he was that diffident. He overcame that shyness, unfortunately, and became vainglorious and corrupted in power and curdled in his own illicit ambitions. But for a while, there was a constitutional monarchy, but that didn't last very long, because that's the nature of human fallen human ambition when it's coupled with power, unfortunately. But this is a good example of the principle that H.L. Mencken talked about when he said the democracy is that theory of government that says that the people know what they want and they deserve to get it good and hard. And I think that that is a really good summary of what divine judgment consists of. If we are persistent in asking or demanding something that is wrong for us, that violates what God has ordained for our happiness, God's eventually going to say, well, you're going to get what you want. It's not what you should get. It's not what will make you happy. But you'll get what you want. And we, as you point out, Dr. Stan, are in that position now in the aggregate as a society because people have become inured to the idea that they can live at each other's expense. That's, of course, the trap of collectivist redistributionist democracy, as Bastiat talks about in the law. When people are taught that they can live at each other's expense, that nullifies society. That creates a situation where we're in a zero-sum relationship with each other. Some people prosper at the expense of others, because when the government's in the position of redistributing wealth, it's not in the position of encouraging plenty, it's in the position of actually imposing scarcity. And now we're finding that we're at the, not even, I think, anywhere near the beginning of what's really going to go haywire with the economy. We're starting to understand now, as this economic contraction deepens, that things are very seriously, deeply wrong in this country, and that there really is no floor under our descent. but we've not even really begun to pick up speed now. We've not even really begun to accelerate. And I don't know how long we're going to fall or how far we're going to fall or how long it's going to be before we feel that unsettling but necessary thump that is our collision as we hit bottom. But people are starting to look at each other now in many communities in this country, many cities, many towns, particularly where you're talking about towns that have large public employee unions. They're looking at each other right now and thinking, okay, they're prospering in a direct way that's directly, or in a way that's directly proportional to my misery, which means that it's more important that I and mine are taken care of than that I do what's right. And when that dynamic afflicts a country, when that dynamic is propagated in the society, ugly things happen very quickly. And I'm afraid we're in for ugliness of the sort that we're seeing right now in Europe, but it's probably going to be on a much, much grander scale, and I'm not looking forward to it.
Well, of course, at least you're up there in Idaho in a small town, which is better than most people living in large communities.
We're
moving into a period of chaos and crisis. I think we're going to move into a period of want. I think there's no better way to destroy a nation than to destroy the value of the currency. And they have done that. They've taken away the gold backing of our currency. There's nothing behind it. And, of course, when the rest of the world repudiates the dollar, then what will we do? We'll be back in just a few moments here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, William Grigg, and go right ahead, William, and I share your concern. I think we're in some very difficult times. My fear is that most Americans are not prepared for it. Most Americans have lived so comfortably, you know, they're always waiting for somebody else. Something always good is going to happen, and of course, at one time, I do believe that God did bless this country and really gave us tremendous prosperity, but I'm afraid those days are simply will very soon become simply a remembrance of things past, and the peace and tranquility we have known will simply be no longer here. Go ahead.
Well, I feel the closing of the parenthesis here, if you will. Even now, if you take a look at what's going on in Europe, you take a look at what's going on in a number of places in Asia and Latin America, as bad as things are right now, the maxim still holds true. I think it was Bismarck who said that God looks out for drunks, small children in the United States of America. Or as a scoutmaster of mine once put it, and I'll never forget this, I was maybe 11, 12 years old when he said this, when America has a cold, the rest of the world has pneumonia. I mean, we're still being protected, and for the life of me, I don't know why, because we're in open rebellion against the law, you know, the law having to do with the two great commandments. You know, we're under the jurisdiction of the Golden Rule, whether we recognize it or not. And unfortunately, that's something against which we're in outright and open rebellion. But there are plenty of auguries right now that what's been ulcerating Greece and is now spread to Romania and Ireland, and of course is threatening places like Spain and Portugal in terms of widespread social unrest and systemic failure, that the United States is maybe six to 18 months away from having the same type of problems erupt here in the United States. And when that does happen, it's going to be interesting to see what happens in terms of the government's actions. I think that in the person of Elena Kagan, you've got a perfect embodiment of the type of official authoritarianism that's going to assert itself very potently when turmoil of that sort afflicts our country. Here's somebody who supports the proposition that the president can summarily execute people who are considered to be terrorists or unlawful combatants, whether they're American citizens or not. Of course, that's not a proper function for the president, whether you're dealing with a citizen or a non-citizen. She supports indefinite detention. She supports the idea that the United States domestically is part of the same battlefield for military operations as any foreign battlefield where the U.S. military is deployed, which means, in principle, she believes that we are under a form, albeit a very mild one, of martial law. And she's somebody who was joined at the hip with Goldman Sachs. I mean, she's a human bridge.
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment with William Greig. And before we go on, William, I want you to tell our listeners how they can get to your blog site. Now I know you've changed your time on your radio program, so how they can get to your radio program, and, of course, how they can get to that PayPal button on your website. And for our listeners out there, Sidney William spends has six children he's got to look after and a lot of obligations. And he spends a great deal of time certainly doing writing and Sidney on the radio programs and here with us every week. And if you're in a position to help him, just he'll tell you how to get to that PayPal button.
I do appreciate that, Dr. Stan. I do appreciate the fact that many members of the audience have been very generous to us, and that's what's supporting us right now. I'm deeply, deeply grateful for that. My blog is called Pro Libertate, Latin for the phrase for freedom, and is found at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. Once again, that's freedominourtime.blogspot.com. And the PayPal button that people can use to make donations if they have the means and the interest in doing so is found at the bottom of every essay. I suppose I could put up at the top, but I would prefer that people read to the end and decide whether or not what I have written is worthy of support. And it's been a real blessing that it's been there. It's not something I was really anxious to do, but it's been very helpful.
I had to just every week call William and just say, have you got your button up there? And then finally, just to actually to keep me from bugging him, he put it up, and I'm so glad it's worked out. Go ahead.
Appreciate that. My radio program is also called Pro Libertate Radio, and it's now on every Saturday night from 8 o'clock to 11 o'clock Mountain Time. I'm in the Mountain Time Zone here in western Idaho, and it would be 7 o'clock to 10 o'clock Pacific Time or 9 o'clock to midnight Central Time on the Liberty News Radio Network, which can be found online at libertynewsradio.com. If you go to libertynewsradio.com, you'll find that there is a list of local affiliates. I believe there are several dozen now local affiliates for Liberty News Radio, so your listeners can go there and find out if there is a terrestrial radio station in their market that carries Liberty News Radio, and if there isn't, we'd sure appreciate it if you'd start talking to people in the local radio industry about coming on board as affiliates. The program is also simulcast live by way of streaming, live streaming online. And I believe there are more than half a dozen different programs people can use. If you have any kind of streaming capacity on your computer, you're going to find a program there that will be compatible. You'll find a format that will work for you. And the program is also archived and available by way of iTunes as a podcast as well. Once again, that's 8 o'clock till 11 o'clock Mountain Time, 7 o'clock to 10 o'clock Pacific Time for Liberty News. Forgive me, for Pro Libertate Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. And once again, the blog is called Pro Libertate. I also do a one-minute radio commentary called the Liberty Minute, which is broadcast on a handful of radio stations. And prolibertate.us, that's P-R-O-L-I-B-E-R-T-A-T-E, prolibertate.us, is where people can go to find the archive of the Liberty Minute radio commentaries. And I'm going to start sometime in the next week and a half or so, I'm going to start doing video commentaries on YouTube on the Freedom Zealot channel. That's one word, Freedom Zealot. If you go to Freedom Zealot, if you just go to YouTube and you type in Freedom Zealot, then you'll be able to find my channel. I don't have any content there yet, but we're working on some programs that we're going to put up there to build my the Freedom Zealot network on YouTube. And it's my genius 12-year-old son who's going to be producing a lot of this content. Like most people his age who've got a creative spark, he knows the ins and outs of computer composition better than I do, and he's completely self-taught. He's going to have to give me some tutelage now in the finer points of composing video and audio programs for YouTube. But that's something that's going to be online in the next couple of weeks. So that's some of what's going on. I've also got another book, my sixth, that I'm getting ready for publication. The working title is The Blood-Dimmed Tide, Reflections on the Rise of the Robber State. It'll be about 300 pages long, maybe a little bit more than that. And as soon as we're close to publication on that, Dr. Stan will let you know about it. Hopefully that'll be out sometime, I'm hoping, mid-summer or thereabouts.
Well, we'll certainly do everything we can to help you get it distributed. Go ahead.
I sure appreciate that. But we were talking about Elena Kagan and how she is sort of a human bridge between these two contending but entirely compatible forms of sort of truculent authoritarian collectivism, how she, on the one hand, is somebody with roots in the same sort of cultural Marxist milieu from which Obama sprang. As a matter of fact, one of the talking points that you're hearing a lot of Elena Kagan's defenders articulate is the idea that she is somebody whose own biography echoes or in some way reflects that of Barack Obama's, if that were a selling point. I suppose that's a selling point to some people. That's certainly not something I would find enchanting. But she's somebody whose background is in the use of the judicial branch to impose cultural changes on the population at large. So she very much is in that activist tradition. And it's something in which you find a lot of activists of a certain perspective wanting to use the power of the courts to inflict supposedly egalitarian changes on the mores of communities that are defined by conventional, generally biblically based moral understandings. I mean, this is where the ACLU, of course, has been such a bane in terms of enhancing the power of the federal judiciary and using the federal judiciary in a bullying sense to try to impose changes on communities, towns, counties, states, and moving them in the direction of supposedly progressive and enlightened views regarding abortion and homosexuality, things of that sort. And Elena Kagan is very much in that tradition. But because she supports the imperial war-making executive and because she supports the idea, for instance, that people who would file an amicus brief on behalf of an accused terrorist should be prosecuted as cohorts of terrorists and perhaps even be subject to having their citizenship stripped from them, those are things that are the most dulcet tones of pure melody to the punitive populists in the Republican coalition, the people who believe that the highest and holiest expression of government power is the torture of suspected terrorists or the saturation bombing of distant countries in the name of the war on terrorism. She's somebody who supports that type of activism as well, as does Barack Obama. I mean, there really isn't much daylight between the two of them when it comes to that element of foreign policy and that element of domestic law in the name of fighting terrorism. So she really is sort of a switch hitter, if you will. I mean, in conventional terms, if you assume that the Republican Party is right, is the right wing, and the Democrat Party is the left wing, then she bats right-handed when it comes to matters of imperial power, and she bats left-handed when it comes to matters of cultural subversion. That's really the synthesis, the Hegelian synthesis of these two very intimately connected variants of interventionist collectivism that we see in the mainstream Republican Party and in the Democrat Party. Now, that's not to say that there aren't Republicans, the United Republicans of California being a really good example, Republican activists in Texas, and I believe just in the last week in Maine as well, there was a platform, a state platform, that was widely derided by establishment Republicans as being a product of the nutcases run amok, that actually reflects genuine conservative values. You see what Rand Paul is doing in Kentucky, and you see the Ron Paul movement nationwide. There are elements of the Republican Party that still harken back to the Robert Taft tradition, that still remember the pre-William F. Buckley conservatism of people like Frank Shadorov and people like Nock and Menten and Garrett Garrett. There is still a heavy residue of people like that. Unfortunately, they're not in charge of the National Republican Party. The National Republican Party is much more simpatico with the likes of Elena Kagan than they would be with Judge Andrew Napolitano, whose former federal judge has become a really outspoken proponent of the restoration of constitutional government. But all this, of course, is taking place, this consolidation of power, this commingling of these various forms of collectivist authoritarianism in the context of a world historic economic collapse. And if we see what's roiling across the Atlantic in Europe right now, we're seeing basically a storm warning. We're seeing a premonitory depiction, sort of a preview of coming tractions for the United States, and it's not going to take that long for the contagion to afflict the United States. There's a piece that was published in the London Telegraph. The economics editor for that paper, Edmund Conway, had this to say about a remarkable press conference that was held just a few days ago in London. Mervyn King, governor of the Bank of England, fears that America shares many of the same fiscal problems currently haunting Europe. He also believes that the European Union must become a federalized fiscal union, in other words, with the central power to tax and spend if it is to survive. Just two of the nuggets from one of the most extraordinary press conferences I have been to at the bank, meaning the Bank of London. And if anybody has a long-term perspective on the banking power, the money power, you'd understand how important this is, because the Bank of London plays a very, very big role in that history. With all that excitement yesterday over our new government, meaning, of course, the new prime minister, I never had time to remark on the inflation report press conference. Most of our attention was on what King said about the government's fiscal plans, King, of course, being the governor of the Bank of England, and he said it was a ringing endorsement. But as Jeremy Warner has written in today's paper, it was as if King had suddenly been unleashed. Bear in mind, King is usually one of the most guarded policymakers in both British and central banking circles, not yesterday. It isn't that often that one has the opportunity to get such a blunt and straightforward insight into the thoughts of one of the world's leading economic players. Most of this stuff usually stays behind closed doors, so it's worth taking note of. Parenthetically, this illustrates my point, Dr. Stan, about how the facade is being taken away and the pretense is being dispensed with. There's a certain candor going on right now, a certain candor in these discussions about the consolidation and exercise of supranational or global power and global governance that we haven't seen previously. And it's interesting in that connection as well that suddenly the Council on Foreign Relations is putting out advertisements that are created for television. They're being broadcast in file-sharing sites like YouTube right now, but they're created for television broadcast, speaking about their supposed good works and the importance that they have and the role that they're playing in terms of supposedly making the world a better place. That is another good example of what I'm talking about here. And then to continue now with the Telegraph report. Most of this stuff usually stays behind closed doors, so it's worth taking note of. And I suspect that while George Osborne will have been happy to hear his endorsement of the new government's policies, Barack Obama and the European leaders will have been far less pleased with his frank comments on their predicament. And then he goes on to talk about the transcript in the video here of what had been said, that in a nutshell, the governor of the Bank of England said was, quote, America and many other large economies, including the UK, share some of the same problems as Greece with its public finances. Every country around the world is in a similar position. Even the United States, the world's largest economy, has a very large fiscal deficit. And then he goes on to talk about how this augurs the same type of social unrest here in the United States that we have seen in Greece. And then he talks about Europe having to become a federalized fiscal union, which is to say a centrally directed, continent-spanning, unitary state. They want to consummate the development of an actual superstate, Soviet-style, if you will, Soviet-style centralized union. And then that is, of course, something that is being discussed in today's Telegraph, London Telegraph, by Ambrose Evans Pritchard, and he puts a much less delicate spin on what Mr. King was talking about. He calls it fiscal fascism. Europe's fiscal fascism brings British withdrawal ever closer. And Mr. Pritchard, Evans Pritchard, in spite of the fact that he's Keynesian, is a very sharp economic commentator about the affliction. He's bad about the treatment, but he's really good in diagnosing the affliction. Then he says the following, by way of opening up this piece, just when he thought the EU could not go any further down the road towards authoritarian excess, it gets worse. The European Commission is calling for EU powers to vet budgets of the 27 member states before the draft laws have been presented to the House of Commons, the Tweedkammer, the Folketing, the Bundestag, the Assemblée Nationale, or other national parliaments. It applies to Britain, even though we are not in the European Monetary Union. Functionaries and EU finance ministers will pass judgment on the British or Dutch or Danish or French budgets before the elected bodies of these ancient and sovereign nations have seen the proposals. Did we not fight the English Civil War and kill a king over such a prerogative? Yet again we are discovering the trick played on our democracies by Europe's insiders when they charged ahead with the EMU, the European Monetary Union, brushing aside warnings by their own staff economists that monetary union was unworkable without fiscal union. Jacques Delors knew perfectly well that this would lead inevitably to a crisis. But it would be the beneficial crisis that would force sovereign parliaments to submit to demands that they would never otherwise accept. Let me repeat that. It would be the, quote, beneficial crisis that would force sovereign parliaments to submit to demands that they would never otherwise accept. And then Ambrose Evans Pritchard continues. This is now playing out before our eyes. Club Med governments have built up 7 trillion euros in sovereign debt under the cover of monetary union, which shut down the warning signals for borrowers and creditors alike. We are now near or beyond the point of no return. Eurozone states must go along with this cynical entrapment or risk economic catastrophe. The conspirators, that's his word, Dr. Stan, the conspirators have succeeded. The 750 billion euro shock and awe package agreed over the weekend clearly alters the character of the European project, crossing the line towards an EU debt union and an EU treasury. How long will it now be before the EU acquires direct tax-raising powers? As French President Nicolas Sarkozy said, we have a veritable economic government. I hope the excellent and proud French people realize what this means before it is too late, as it is for the Greek, Irish, Portuguese, and Spanish peoples. They are being forced by the logic of the economic machine to squeeze fiscal policy at a time when they are either in recession or trapped in a deeper perma-slump without offsetting stimulus. Now, there's where, unfortunately, Mr. Evans Pritchard lapses into Keynesian orthodoxy, which is unfortunate. But I want to point out a couple of very excellent things about this commentary. The first is he refers to it as a conspiracy. He talks about the idea of a beneficial crisis hurting people in a certain preordained direction. And then you have an English patriot commending the patriotic people of France to rise up against this effort to steal their country. You know what? The same thing is happening here in the United States. And that's a prospect, of course, that's going to become the same type of grim reality for the American population sometime, probably before the end of this year or the next.
Well, of course, this is so reminiscent of Henry Kissinger's article in the International Herald Tribune in January of last year, talking about, you know, either we're all going to have to go to the new international financial order or face chaos. We go along or we face chaos. Which do you want? Well, most people are going to go along. And with that, the loss of all freedom. We'll be right back. Well, that's a fascinating analysis, and because I always read everything that Ambrose Edgman Pritchard writes. I had the opportunity of interviewing him several times.
Heart disease is on the rise. Clogged arteries, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol levels may not be fully detected by you, but the symptoms are there. Loss of energy, blood sugar spikes and drops, poor circulation, and irregular heartbeat are just a few of these that can alert you that something is wrong. Hear how Heart and Body Extract is making a difference in thousands of people's lives across America.
My blood pressure has normalized. My diabetes has totally improved.
Everyone is telling me now how much healthier I look, and I'm telling everyone how much healthier I feel. I recommend Heart and Body Extract to everyone.
Anybody over 40 in the North American continent should be using this product as a preventative to keep their cardiovascular system healthy.
Order your 2-month supply today by calling 866-295-5305. That's 866-295-5305. Or order online, hbextract.com. Heart and Body Extract, 866-295-5305 or hbextract.com.
Well, I was horrified when I saw the plight of the people in Haiti after the earthquake, but a similar event could happen right here in the United States, and that's why you should call the freeze-dry guy at 866-404-FOOD, that's 866-404-FOOD, and purchase a supply of his products. Freeze-drying is a great way to preserve food. I know because I bought a supply 40 years ago, and when I opened a can recently, the food was as fresh and tasty as when I purchased it.
We're living in uncertain times, so if you'd like to have a supply of ground beef, diced beef, chicken, vegetables, or fruit on hand, call the freeze-dry guy at 866-404-FOOD. That's 866-404-FOOD, and mention you heard about him right here at Radio Liberty.
Where are my car keys? What did I come in this room for? Where did I put that?
A common condition called age-related memory loss is robbing millions of people of their ability to remember and think clearly. And Alzheimer's and Parkinson's are occurring at younger ages, even early 20s and 30s. And there's much evidence that brain inflammation may be the cause. Brain inflammation may also cause depression and insomnia. But there's great news. Studies show by taking special, powerful nutrients, brain inflammation and its damaging effects may be greatly reduced. And that's why neurosurgeon Dr. Russell Blaylock created his brain repair formula to reduce brain inflammation and maintain a healthy brain. So, for a free book on brain health or information on Dr. Blaylock's special brain repair formula, call 1-800-SPECIAL or visit 1-800-SPECIAL.com. 1-800-SPECIAL.